The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
From Master Dogen's Genjo Koan, Part 5. When you first seek the truth, you separate yourself far from its environs. When you have already correctly transmitted the truth to yourself, you are your original self at that very moment. When riding on a boat, if you watch the shore, you may assume that the shore is moving. But watching the boat directly, you know that it is the boat that moves. If you examine the 10,000 dharmas with a deluded body and mind, you will suppose that your mind and nature are permanent. But if you practice intimately and return to the true self, it will be clear that the 10,000 dharmas are without self. So just a reminder that this is our theme study for the Ango, this fascicle by Dogen, Master Dogen. And Genjo Koan is translated in different ways, but Mazuma Roshi translated as the way of everyday life. When you first seek the truth, you separate yourself far from its environs. The Soto Shu translation says, people, when they first seek the Dharma, remove themselves far from the borders of the Dharma. So when Dogen wrote this in the 1200s, this was so. The time of the Buddha, it was so. It's still true in our time. And we're not really to blame, in a sense. Why would it be otherwise, really? We come seeking something. We leave home. We look outside of ourselves to find something. And so we encounter the Dharma, Zen, teachings, practices, a monastery, Zazen, a session. We encounter these, we hear about them, we learn about them, we reflect on them, we practice them. Teachings point to all matter of existence and phenomena. We have some sense of where we are. We probably have a fairly well worked out plan of where we want to be. And even if we have faith that, you know, no one can save us, it's got to come from within. That what we'll ultimately discover has to be already within us in some way, or maybe will be the result of something we do. Even within that faith, we're experiencing everything as coming from outside. Even our inside seems to strangely be coming from somewhere else. And, you know, throughout all of our lives, from the beginning, everything we've needed seems to come from the outside. Food, shelter, clothing, warmth, love. And if we really had faith that what we were seeking and what would liberate us was already present within us, and would we even seek? And so we come in, and one of the first things that happens when we walk in the door is we're taught how to sit, which is kind of interesting. You know, it's like seeing a nice building that you want to check out, and somebody invites you in and takes you into a room where there's a nuclear reactor. And says, okay, why don't you just stay here a while? So the very first thing that happens is, in a sense, is the most radical thing, the most profound thing. In another sense, you could say the most simple thing. Certainly the necessary thing. And so we're brought to our seat and left alone. left to find our way. And with some encouragement of what to do with our minds and bodies and what to do when we want to fly away. I mean, over the years I've heard from numerous people who've said that they would have at some point gotten up, run out screaming, but they would have been embarrassed. So they didn't. Embarrassment can work. So we can be left with the one true thing. It's like, I always think of it as being washed up on a deserted island. No one's coming. And everything that you need, you have to find on that island. Whatever you need, you're going to have to find on that island. In that book that I've quoted a lot, Deep Survival, about people who are in survival situations, he talks about how one of the characteristics of many people who are basically in hopeless situations, in the woods, in the desert, out in the middle of the ocean, on a mountain, that one of the key things that he found in people who survived is that they're not waiting for somebody to come and get them. And when they're not, if they're waiting for somebody to get them, come and get them, then they wait. And while they wait, sometimes they just die. But if they're not waiting for somebody to get them, then naturally what they need to do is live. So they need to go about the stuff of living. What do they need to do? It's a little like that. As Tadaroshi Roshi said, that no one knows from the beginning that they are already Buddha. Then he says, feeling no sense of responsibility today, we may superficially hear these words. Though we may say we understand them, it's not really so. He says, even the Buddha didn't know that he was Buddha. I always hold back a little bit from projecting into what exactly the Buddha knew and thought. And it's interesting that he says, feeling no responsibility today, we may superficially hear those words. What responsibility is he talking about? As though being Buddha, having enlightened nature, enlightened mind, having all of the stuff of a Buddha, of the Buddha, it's as though there is then a responsibility. Especially once we are introduced to that truth. Then we have a responsibility. It's like realizing that you're endowed with some life-saving skill or knowledge or tool, and you decide not to use it. Though we may say we understand it, it's not really so. That too, I think, you can't really blame anybody for. It's a nice thought. It's a nice idea, but it's just too extreme, too radical, too other, too outside. It's so close. It just seems so distant. So there are these phrases, don't put a head on top of the one you already have. If you meet the Buddha on the road, kill the Buddha. If you see something outside of yourself, don't be fooled. And I was thinking, Shon Osho the other day talked about devotion. And last Ango, I think, we did a Ango intensive where we talked a little bit about devotion and prayer. And I was thinking about this in terms of not seeking outside, this fundamental teaching and just basic fact of not just Buddhism, but the way things are. Because the Buddha realized, and he seemed to know this from the beginning. This is why I hesitate to put too many words in the Buddha's mouth. That he seemed to understand that from the beginning, before he was enlightened, that anything that he could do within his meditation or in any other way, no matter what experience it brought him to, no matter how sublime or tranquil or freeing it felt, he knew already that that was not ultimately liberation. Because it was a result of something he was doing. Being done, at some point it would come undone. That's why when he went to study with those two different meditation masters and accomplished what they had to teach, and they invited him to teach alongside of them, which you'd think somebody who just came from a place of high position, where that's not only what he was supposed to do, but that's what he had been taught his purpose was. That's who you are. You're the person who leads. And then to have been in this other situation where essentially in a different context, the same thing happens. You would think for anybody else, that would be a hard hook not to bite onto. But he didn't, because he knew that what he had experienced, although these teachers were saying, this is liberation, within himself, he said, no, it's not. It can't be, because it is a result of, it's a conditioned experience. It will come apart. And so this not seeking outside. And then there is the practice within Buddhism of prayer, which in my early years and youthful arrogance, I thought, well, that's just bullshit. When I came across teachers talking about prayer, I thought, no, we don't do that. You know, and I'm reading the writings of some accomplished teacher, and I'm like a puppy dog. You know, I'm like a polywog. I'm not even out of the water yet. And I'm quite clear that that's not Buddhism, you know. The audacity of my youth, I don't know. I won't speak for you. And I just thought, no, we don't do that. Why? Because we don't put a head on top of the one we already have. Who am I going to pray to? They can't save me. Do those contradict each other? Tori Zenji says, we chanted it. I think we chanted it yesterday. Our deepest prayer is to be firm in our determination to give ourselves completely to the Buddha's way, so that no doubts arise, however long the road seems to be light and easy in the four parts of the body, to be strong and undismayed in body and mind, to be free from illness and drive out both depressed feelings and distractions. This is a full prayer, to pray for these things. And then Hakuin Zenji in the Song of Zazen says, from the beginning, all beings are Buddhas, like water and ice. Without water, no ice. Outside you, no Buddha. How near the truth, yet how far we seek. Like one in the midst of water crying, I'm thirsty. Like the child of a rich parent wandering around the earth, complaining about how poor they are. I was reading something recently by Alan Wallace, a Vajrayana teacher, who he talked about prayer. And he said, if a single person or a community of people has the karma to experience some adversity, is there any benefit in praying for them? If so, does it depend on who's doing the praying? That is it effective only if the person doing the prayer has great spiritual power? In other words, for it to be powerful or effective, does it have to come from a person who's spiritually accomplished? He says, I can't judge the power of one person's prayers over those of another, but what I do know is that the three jewels, the three treasures, do have the power to be able to help people in times of adversity by removing their obstacles and so on. Therefore, because of the power of the three treasures, there is certainly benefit in offering prayers for other people's well-being. This is true of everyone's prayers, not only of those of spiritual teachers. So it is very worthwhile to pray for others. You may wonder whether there's any benefit in praying for those who suffer from natural disasters and things of that order. My response is that there is certainly benefit in praying for people who are suffering, be they strangers, your loved ones, relatives, or anyone. Prayers for their benefit contribute to the alleviation of their suffering. The power of those prayers stems from the three treasures. But your prayers can be a contributing influence for this benefit. They can be effective both in removing temporary obstacles as well as much deeper spiritual obstacles. Bear in mind, too, that praying for the benefit of others is also a benefit to the person making the prayers, the one who is praying. So concerning this, I encourage you to sweep aside your doubts and know that such prayers are useful and virtuous. So in a sense, that begs the question, what is a prayer? Right? He's using that word, in a sense, assuming that we know what that means. What does it mean to pray? To pray for what? Well, for the alleviation of suffering. To whom? By what power? Is that prayer have the potential to effect some change? It cannot be measured, right? And yet, the one who is praying can recognize that it has an effect on them. When we do the four measurables every morning, that's taught traditionally as a meditation. Is it different from a prayer? We're speaking, we're calling out, wishing for well-being for others in very specific ways. Compassion, loving kindness, sympathetic joy, equanimity, life-giving, life-affirming, life-liberating qualities. What's going on there? And how does that work within a tradition which is very clear that the Buddha is not like the God, as in the Western concept of God? He was a human being, even though in the Lotus Sutra he said, look, I'm just showing up in this form as a Ramanakaya Buddha because I never went away. The cosmic Buddha. In the Buddha's lifetime, he was born, he had a mother, he was raised by Mahapajapati, had a father, had a wife, a son. He got sick, he got old. When he was very old, and Ananda was basically saying, you know, could you just live forever? And he was like, what do you want from me? He said, like, I'm like an old cart that's held together by straps. You know, I'm coming apart. And then he died. So Buddhism is very clear about that. The bodhisattvas, Avalokiteshvara, Manjushri, Samantabhadra, are non-historical. Buddhism is very clear about that. And yet we invoke their names. Last night we chanted, Namu, be one with. What's going on? And how does that all arise from the understanding of not seeking outside? So some people might say, well, when I pray to a bodhisattva, for instance, I'm really just talking to myself. I've thought that, I've said that. And remember that article we read by Ken MacLeod, I think in the last Ango Intensive, he said, that's one way of looking at it. He said, but that's a very sort of diminished way of looking at it. In a way, it's a very psychological way of looking at it. Each of us has to find our own path, our own way within the path, and work it out. When I spoke this morning, I think about, you know, the Dharma is so magnificent because it can meet the particular person that you are, which is unique, right? Nobody else has ever been born with exactly the constituent parts that make up you. That's kind of cool. And so the Dharma can meet, and every single sentient being is like that. And the Dharma can meet the particular delusion and suffering and the whole thing, the whole catastrophe, in deep, deep understanding and skillfulness and guidance. So it's extremely particular, as it has to be, and at the same time, by virtue of that, it's universal. So we each have to find our own path, and everybody needs help. Everybody. Now, Pratyeka Buddha is said to be somebody who comes to realization on their own. So I don't know what that means, you know, in terms of sort of the details of that historically. Do they live in a box? Do they live in a vacuum? Have they never had any influences? But it means that they come to realization without a direct teacher. Let's not worry about that right now. I'm going to assume that each of us needs help. Otherwise, why would we be here? Dogen goes on, when you have already correctly transmitted the truth to yourself, you are your original self at that very moment. At the moment of transmitting the truth to yourself, what is transmitted is you are your original self. at that moment, at the previous moment, at every moment. As Tsongkhapa Roshi says, though seeking the Dharma may be fundamentally a mistake, this is a mistake we must knowingly make. This mistake has been transmitted down to us since the time of the Buddha, over these many centuries. Beginning with the Buddha, he went seeking, right? He went searching. He studied with teachers. He became an ascetic. He probably had innumerable conversations, right? Because there were all of these wandering mendicants doing different practices in different communities with different sort of views of what liberation was and how to get there. Mazuma Roshi, in his commentary, talks about the three marks of existence, which is a basic fundamental Buddhist teaching, which are the three marks that are part of every aspect of existence, the first being impermanent, that all things are absent of any lasting quality or characteristic. To say everything changes is true, and it's, you know, it kind of barely scratches the surface of the depth and breadth of that fundamental truth and teaching that the Buddha said, we really must see this very clearly. It was one of those kind of non-optional things, you know. This has to be understood. We have to see this and get it, right? As deep as we can, the truth of this. Because in not knowing that, in thinking that things are permanent, we will rely on them. We'll rely on them to give us some lasting something that we want. And they can't. And so that will inevitably and with certainty lead to uncertainty, insecurity, and a desire to find something else, or just double down. But whatever we find, same thing's going to happen. All things have the mark of impermanence. All things are empty of any abiding, independent nature, existence, essence. When we see things from the point of things having their own existence, then logically and in our sort of basic way of experiencing things, that thing, because when I look at it, I get a little bit of a thrill. It seems pretty clear that's coming from that thing. A car, a person, a job, a title. And so I want that thing because I like that thrill and I want more of it. And so that sense of things having their own existence, its own power, and I want it to give that some of that power to me. Or when I see something that I don't like, and I think that has the power to make me unhappy, to make me angry, to make me lonely, that's also imbuing a false sense of owned being into that. So the second mark is that all things are absent of any fixed essence, which is another way of saying any inherent power. And the third mark is that all things is nirvana. All things are fundamentally peaceful. They abide within their own state. They are thus. When we have correctly transmitted the truth to ourselves, we are our original self. Impermanent, absent of self, peaceful. And this does not come from the outside. It does not come from Buddha. It does not come from a teacher. It does not come from a teaching. Formal transmission in our tradition is really the recognition that the student has correctly transmitted the truth to themselves. The teacher confirms that. The student must know it through their direct experience. In other words, they must have a confidence that's true, that that is true, at the same time that they may have doubts and insecurities. Along with those doubts and insecurities, they must at the same time know that the teacher is not making a mistake. And it's an interesting little complex to hold. Actually, it's quite wonderful. to be able to hold that because it's true. What is happening for you this week? Whatever has come about through your practice, if you're in residency, through your residency, it's you. One of the things I often say to somebody when they're leaving residence is, what has happened during this time, you're taking with you. Don't think that you're leaving something behind. Of course, there's this, there's training, there's teachings, there's all that this enables us to do. Of course. But after all, it's you. And so when you leave, you take what you need with you. All along the path, in moments of practice and verification, receiving, affirming, verifying, that happens through some form of contact, intimate contact. Even if we're just reading something, and there's a shift or there's a sense of something, there's something that gets through, that goes in. It's not just like reading something else. It's not just like any other moment. You know it. You experience it. That's a moment of making contact. The Dharma advancing and entering the true self. Self-fulfilling samadhi. And as Sean mentioned, that sense of, you know, we think it's hard to think of self-fulfilling as not self-clinging, self-gratifying, self-me. That it's practiced by and affirmed by the self. I mean, it has to be like that, right? It has to be like that because otherwise, if it's not self-affirming, it can't be affirmed. If the teacher affirms it to you and you've had no interior experience of that affirmation, what value, what worth is that? It's just like somebody saying you're doing a great job and you don't believe it. When intimate language encounters an intimate person, a person in a state of intimacy, the Buddha eye sees the unseen. Intimate action is not known by the self or by other. The intimate self alone knows it. So it's not only that it's difficult to express because words can't convey, but because the intimate self alone knows it. And that intimate self is not a part, is not in the realm of language. And yet it's important to express. And so all of these poetics and imagery and metaphors and similes. But why the emphasis on correct when the Dharma is correctly transmitted? Why don't we speak about true Dharma? There's a sutra in which some of the Buddha's monastics were out. They were going to go begging for alms. It was too early, they realized. So they went to a park where there were a bunch of different wanderers hanging out. So they went out to hang out with them. And so they're talking, and one of the groups came over and said, you guys are with the Buddha, right? And they said, yeah. And they said, well, the Buddha teaches mindfulness and the seven factors of enlightenment, doesn't he? And they said, yeah, he does. And they said, well, we teach that too. So how is what he's teaching any different from what we're teaching? And in the sutra, it's very interesting because they said they didn't accept it and they didn't reject it. They didn't argue. They said, let's go check it out. So they went and got their alms, had their meal, then they went and found the Buddha and sat down and told him and said, how would you respond? And the Buddha answered in a very sort of concise way, as often he would. But the way I read into that was, they may talk about these seven factors of enlightenment, but what do they teach when the student encounters this, or this, or this, or this, or this, or this, or this? And do they recognize that when they encounter this, these factors are not helpful? And when they encounter this, these factors are not helpful? In other words, he went into the depth, the subtlety, the nuance of his teaching of that. And he said, that's not what they're teaching. And it made me think of in the early years when Dada Roshi would talk about, you know, when somebody says, you know, they've been practicing for 20 or 30 years. And he said, that may be true, and that's wonderful, but what does it mean? You know, what does it mean when two or three or four or five people say, we've all been practicing for 20 years? That can mean wildly different things. And so this sense of the correct Dharma, which is the correct Dharma is the Dharma that's liberating, that's based in things as they are, and that is skillful for a sentient being. And so Dogen goes on to say, when riding in a boat, if one watches the shore, you may assume that the shore is moving. But watching the boat directly, you know that it is a boat that is moving. And it's an interesting example, because we've all probably had something like that, right? Whether in a boat or you're sitting on a train next to another train, one of them starts moving, and for a few moments, you don't know which one's moving, right? So it's a little bit of trickery of perception. So we assume that the shore is moving, but actually when you watch the boat, see where you are, you realize that it's the boat that's moving, not the shore. So why does he bring this up? What's his point? Looking out, everything seems to be moving. It seems that we are just observing from our own unmoving place. I'm not doing anything. I'm just watching. I'm just looking. I'm just hearing. Right? That's my only involvement. I don't have anything to do with what's going on over there. It's over there. And Dogen is saying, no, it's not like that. But a Dharma is saying, no, it's not like that. In the Mountains and Rivers Sutra, Dogen says, the way of seeing mountains and rivers differs according to the type of being that sees them. There are beings who see what we call water as a jeweled necklace. This doesn't mean, however, that they see a jeweled necklace as water. How then do we see what they consider water? Their jeweled necklace is what we see as water. Or again, they see water as miraculous flowers, though it doesn't follow that they use flowers as water. Hungry ghosts see water as raging flames or as pus and blood. Dragons and fish see it as a palace or a tower. It's a basic Buddhist teaching, and it's so interesting how, I can't remember the name of the book, I think it's Edward Yong came out, about just, and there are other, a lot of research into the sensory experience of all different kinds of creatures. How they see. A lot of creatures don't see with their eyes. How they smell. They don't smell with a nose. How they feel. They don't feel with touch. We look out and we see the world in a certain way and think, well, that's just the way the world is. But clearly the world appears very, very different depending on the creature that is looking out, the sensory equipment that they have. From their own place, they see the world. Because we have consciousness, we do the same thing, and we also just make up a whole lot of stuff. Right? We are creating, manufacturing, dreaming, fantasizing, speculating, which in and of itself, we could just render as distraction. What makes it so volatile is that we believe in it pretty absolutely, at least initially. And it can be damn hard to get us to consider another possibility. And so looking out in that way then, and experiencing things coming in, then it's like, well, who's doing this to me? Why? Are you my friend or are you my enemy? Whose side are you on anyway? And so we can have one extreme of thinking it's all out there. I'm just a neutral observer. Why do you keep bothering me? On the other hand, we can come into Buddhism, start studying and think, oh, it's all me. It has nothing to do with what's going on outside. That's just another extreme. It's dependently arising, which means we can't ignore anything. It made me think of when I was waiting tables in New York many years ago, and I was being trained by my elders in the Waitron world. And they were actually older. They seemed quite old to me. They were probably in their 30s or 40s. You know. But they seemed very old and very professional. And so they took me under their wing, which was great. And so they basically gave me the score. So one of the things they taught was, you know, you go up to a table and you kind of suss them out, right? Because I'm the pro, right? You're the guest. And so my job is sort of know in advance how this is going to go, right? And even, you know, kind of guide them along the way in ways that may just build up the bill a little bit. I never did that, actually, just to be. I did steal shirts and things like that and other kinds of things, but I didn't do that. But one of the things I loved about that job was that I would do that. I mean, they didn't even have to encourage me. I would have done it, right? And go up and I see the way they look, the way they dress, the way they talk to me, what they're ordering. It's like, yeah, I've got you guys figured out. You're going to tip me well, you're not, you're going to be a pain in the ass, you're going to be nice. And time and time again, I mean, every once in a while it kind of played out, but time and time again, they would completely surprise me. Sometimes I would think, this is going to be a really excellent table, and they would be awful and leave me nothing. And sometimes I would look at them and think, you are not going to leave me anything because I don't think you have much. And they would leave some incredible something of generosity. Sometimes it wasn't in wealth, but it was something else. Or so they would just say something completely unasked for. That was not part of me giving you food and you having your meal, just out of the blue. And I just would continually get proven wrong, which was such a good thing, right? I don't know. If you examine the 10,000 dharmas with a deluded body and mind, you'll suppose that your mind and nature are permanent. And of course, here's the catch. And we will suppose it's actually much stronger than that, much more definite. If the mind and nature are permanent in our view, then everything is permanent. Even in its changing, we still see it as something that has an essence. And if it's permanent, then it exists by itself. And other things do too, and me. And if things have an independent self, then there's definitely going to be suffering. There's going to be conflict. There's going to be disappointment and sadness. Conflict and strife are inevitable. Because nothing lasts, I will be disappointed. I will feel betrayed. I will be unsatisfied, and I will feel insecure if I will admit it. I might not, but I will be insecure because it's not working. And that insecurity is significant, since I'm doing everything I'm supposed to be doing, I'm getting all the good things, or as much as I can get, I'm following the example of those around me, and it's just not working. It's working enough that life goes on, but that's not actually what I'm seeking. But if you practice intimately and return to the true self, it will be clear that the 10,000 dharmas are empty of self. And this is our practice, to practice intimately, step by step, moment by moment, day by day, one release, one entering, bit by bit, patience. It will be clear that the 10,000 dharmas are empty of self. Another translation says, if you become intimate with your conduct, and return here, the principle that the myriad dharmas are not self is clear. Another is when you attend closely to your actions in the place where you are, which I particularly like. And so then think about it. So intimacy is really the fundamental dissolving of any sense of boundary. But to attend closely to your actions along the way in the place where you are. And so last night we had Fasatsu. we did the Gatha of Atonement, and Hojin Sensei spoke really beautifully about atonement, the power of that. I mean, think about it. If everything that you had ever done, that I had ever done that caused harm, if there was nothing I could do about it to release that from within myself, but it just kept accumulating and accumulating and accumulating, which it does, what kind of hell realm is that? And so to have this very powerful way to free ourselves, not forget what we've done, but to free ourselves of our grasping, of our identifying with. And so we have precepts. How can I live and work with all of this when I want to kill, or I want to steal, or I want to talk about you badly, or I want to cloud my mind and get away from it all? How do I even know that that's a problem? Well, the precepts say that pretty clearly. Well, what do I do? They give me instruction on what to do. Well, if I'm not doing that, what else could I be doing? They tell me that as well. And to give it power, we have vow. Because all of that is like the best meal ever. But without vow, you can't digest it. You can slosh it around in your mouth for a little bit, but you can't digest it. It won't assimilate. It won't stay with you. And these vows, if I may say, you don't shit them out. Just to follow the food analogy. It's all there. That's why Dada Roshi emphasized the precepts so much. As he would often say, wisdom without compassion is not yet true wisdom. Compassion without wisdom is not yet true compassion. They arise together, they need each other, they're ultimately not separate. That's why we have to practice them together. And so we spend this week deep within my mind, your mind, your Buddha mind, but without forsaking those around us, and very specifically taking care of each other in particular ways. The Buddha said it in many, many different ways. But he said, when we live without creating harm, then we don't have regret. And we're not carrying that burden of regret, then we will quite naturally feel joy, a lightness of being. And when we have that lightness of being, then it's natural to be delighted by others' well-being, accomplishments, successes. And that gladness brings happiness. It makes us happy. And when we're happy, our body and mind become serene. They're not agitated. They're not anxious. They're tranquil. And the Buddha said that is a most conducive state for your meditation. And in that state, you're in a most conducive state to see things clearly. And so you see how he saw this as all one thing. One person, one life, thought, words, and actions. So we have to practice it that way. So. The things that come to mind. I was just thinking of something Dada Roshi used to say a lot, because it was in my interview with Shoban, my narrative, about how Dada Roshi, who was in the Navy, and talked about the Seabees. Now, this is all based on his narrative. I don't know anything, but for my own, Miro probably knows. But that the Seabees were like a construction crew in the Navy. So they would show up and like, just build a bridge, just build it. And that their motto was, can do, will do, done. So we might just modify that slightly. Can do, am doing, am doing. Right, I didn't think that through in advance. But it works. Okay, doing is the point. Give up, done. doing.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.